You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. Kick-Ass Politics is sponsored by Fiverr. You've heard me rave about Fiverr before. That's Fiverr with two R's. Fiverr is the world's largest online marketplace for services, with over 100 categories all offered at a fixed base price of just $5. Logo design, business consulting, marketing, business cards and stationery, web design, translation, proofreading, legal consulting, and just about any other service you can imagine, all offered at a fixed base price of just $5. And right now, if you go to kickasspolitics.com and click on the Fiverr ad on our sponsor page, you'll be showing your support for the show, and you'll get some great offers on services tailored to your needs. Whatever you need done, find it on Fiverr. And before we start the show, I want to ask for you, the listeners, help with a special project. Over the next few weeks, we're going to be doing a listener survey to get a better idea of who our audience is. No matter how long you've been a listener or how frequently you listen to the show, we'd like to get to know you better and what you want. So I hope you'll visit our website at kickasspolitics.com and click on the listener survey link on the homepage, or there's a survey link in the show notes to this episode. It's just a few quick questions to help us understand who's listening, and seriously, it'll be a huge, huge help to me personally. The other thing you can do to help the show is to go on your Facebook page and Twitter to tell your friends to subscribe to Kick-Ass Politics on iTunes. And if you do that, each week you'll be entered to win a signed copy of a book by one of my recent guests. To be entered to win, just go on Twitter or Facebook and recommend Kick-Ass Politics to your friends. Be sure to include a link to the show on iTunes so they can subscribe. And don't forget to tag us in your posts so we know you participated and we can include you in the drawing. And hey, if you want to double your chances of winning, then promote the show on both Facebook and Twitter. In fact, you'll be entered to win for every time that you recommend Kick-Ass Politics to your friends on your social media. Just help me gain some new listeners, and you'll have a shot at winning a cool prize every week. And now, enjoy the show. Hi there, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass Politics. I'm honored to have a true Washington legend on the show today, author and journalist Bob Woodward. In 1972, together with fellow Washington Post reporter Carl Bernstein, Bob Woodward reported extensively on the Watergate scandal, tying it all the way up the chain of command to President Nixon himself, and eventually leading to Nixon's resignation. Gene Roberts, former managing editor of the New York Times, called Woodward and Bernstein's work, quote, maybe the single greatest reporting of all time. And my guest in the previous episode, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, called Woodward, quote, the best pure reporter of his generation, perhaps ever. Woodward and Bernstein won the Washington Post a Pulitzer Prize for their reporting on the Watergate scandal. And in 2001, Bob Woodward again earned a Pulitzer Prize for the Post as the main reporter in that paper's coverage of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Today, Woodward remains an associate editor for the Washington Post, and along the way, he's authored or co-authored no less than 17 national bestsellers, including a dozen books that made it to the number one spot on the New York Times bestseller list for nonfiction. That includes the classic All the King's Men, which was later made into a movie in which Bob Woodward was portrayed by actor Robert Redford. Well, now he's revisiting Nixon in his new book called The Last of the President's Men, which is based on countless documents and firsthand interviews with Alexander P. Butterfield, Butterfield was the right-hand man of Nixon's chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, and today, for all purposes, he's the last of the true insiders left from the Nixon White House. As a matter of fact, he's the guy who oversaw the installation of that infamous recording system in Nixon's Oval Office, and he's also the one who later revealed the existence of the Nixon tapes to the Watergate Committee. Today, Bob Woodward and I will talk about what Butterfield revealed to him about Watergate, Vietnam, and the complicated and disturbed man that was President Richard Nixon. Coming up with my guest, Bob Woodward, in just a moment.
To Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
Today I'm joined over the phone by two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist Bob Woodward. He has had a dozen number one New York Times bestsellers, but he will forever be known as the man who, with his former colleague at the Washington Post, Carl Bernstein, broke the Watergate scandal that brought down Richard Nixon. Well, now he's returning to his roots in a way, with his latest book, The Last of the President's Men, which chronicles the White House career of Alexander Butterfield, who was one of Nixon's closest lieutenants, and the man who oversaw the installation of the infamous taping system in the Oval Office and subsequently revealed it to the Watergate Committee. Bob, thanks for coming on the show to talk about this fascinating book.
Thank you.
The book is about a man named Alexander P. Butterfield, who, when Nixon first got elected, I believe he was an Air Force colonel who was stationed, stationed in Australia. And then, thanks to luck and an old college acquaintance, he ends up in the inner circle of the most corrupt president of the 20th century. Talk about who Alexander Butterfield is and how he came to the White House.
He had this front row seat in the Nixon White House because he was Haldeman being the chief of staff, his deputy, and did a lot of the little chores for Nixon and had the office right next to Nixon's Oval Office and had a door where he could go in at any time or Nixon could come see him and make these requests. So it's in a way the perfect witness, and seeing there were no secret tapes for the first 2 years, Butterfield, who is now 89, still has a fabulous detailed memory, was kind of the tape recorder. So what he has provided, not only from the recollections and his story never told before, but 20 boxes of documents that he lifted from the White House, and some of them contain original documents and things that have never been seen before that are not in the libraries or the archives. And it's in particularly the Vietnam, the management of the Vietnam War. It shows the other side of Watergate being, I'll get reelected at any cost, by sabotage the Democrats. Also, we find he was managing the Vietnam War with an eye to re-election. There's one particular memo where Nixon takes a top secret document Kissinger has sent him and writes a personal note to Kissinger, his national security advisor, saying, "We've done all this years of bombing and the result, zilch. It's a total failure." And, of course, we now know that Nixon had that right, but publicly he was declaring it was very effective and always a necessary pillar of his Vietnam War strategy. But even realizing that it wasn't working in the year 1972 when he was running for re-election, he intensified the bombing and having served in the Navy during the Vietnam era, having followed Vietnam closely and Nixon, I was really shocked by
this
level of corruption.
Yeah, outside of the personal revelations about Nixon as a man that come out in this book, I think this is the most shocking and extraordinary thing that comes up, is this memo that apparently no one else had, that Butterfield just magically produced for you. And it's amazing because you talk about how he said this a day after he went on with Dan Rather and said that the bombings were working. A day later, he's writing notes to Kissinger saying, in his own words, it's a failure. The results from dropping 2.9 million tons of bombs in Laos and North Vietnam was, again, in his own words, zilch. He tells Kissinger he wants a Barkov study within 2 weeks and a no-snow job. Otherwise, continued operations make no sense. Were you more outraged that he said this a day after he went on Dan Rather and said that the bombings were working? Or were you more outraged that he finally seemed to get it in this memo and call for a change of course, but then absolutely nothing came from it?
Well, both. There is a sacred, unsigned contract between the commander-in-chief and everyone, millions of people in the military at that time, that you do your job, I'll do my job. And the commander-in-chief's job is to manage the war, to win it, and to protect all of the servicemen, and to not kill people unnecessarily. And the wanton bombing of Vietnam there really aren't words to describe it, and it's... That Nixon was in such a self-imposed bubble to think what's important here is his re-election and not think of the consequences on human beings in Southeast Asia, including the servicemen serving under him, who, many of them, 20,000 of them died while Nixon was president, as he prosecuted this war. And it's a matter of corruption and almost a war crime to realize that you're achieving zilch. Virtually all the combat troops are out. The war is lost. It's over. But it's continued for the purpose of re-election, saving face, peace with honor was the goal. Well, where is the honor in this? There's none.
Well, who would you blame more for not following up on that memo? Was it Kissinger's fault? Was it his failing? Or was it Nixon for not insisting beyond that one memo for more accountability and a change of strategy?
Well, ultimately, the president's responsible. Now, I asked Kissinger about this. He said he did not recall the specific memo. I've authenticated it, by the way. It is definitely legitimate and definitely in Nixon's own handwriting. But the president has to follow through if something isn't done. When I asked Kissinger, he said, well, things came in, requests, and sometimes they meant something and sometimes they didn't. Well, I mean, my God, what was going on here? Suppose this was known at the time. Again, this is beyond words, in my estimation.
It would have been a huge scandal, I'm sure.
Well, it would have been a scandal would have been, there's a moral dimension to being president. And that's what Watergate was about, the lack of morality and the law breaking and the criminality. But when you are in a war, we are now in wars. And there's much debate and are we going to send ground troops? Well, Obama said he's going to send 50. Special operations people.
Right.
I mean, look back. Don't we know history? And history and John F. Kennedy started out the engagement in Vietnam incrementally, baby steps of troops here, advisors here, low combat troops here, where don't we learn and understand and think about this? So in many ways, in every way, this book is about Nixon, but it's also a warning. Who are these people? What are they doing? We know we've got so much secrecy now, so many things hidden. I think people are getting sick and tired of the hidden. Let's have little transparency. Let's explain what people are really doing. And this presidential campaign, who are these people? We know a lot, in my view, not enough.
Well, I'm curious, do you think that there's more secrecy today than there was back during Watergate?
Well, there was criminality being concealed.
Right.
And we have, to my knowledge, no evidence of outright criminality. We have a lot of questions, a lot of, you know, FBI investigation of Hillary Clinton's emails. 700 of them, turns out, have classified information. And, you know, the defense, well, it wasn't marked classified. Come on. I mean, your Secretary of State, you know, generally speaking, what's classified and what's serious and what should be protected. And when the FBI investigates, that's not to issue a general accounting office report and slap people on the wrist. They investigate possible crimes. Now, we don't know, and she's entitled to due process and no rush to judgment, but it's going on, and we've got a war going on.
Yeah.
So we've got kind of pre-scandal, and we've got all these wars, and how are they being managed? For what purpose? What are we being told?
Yeah.
Does it make sense? Anyway.
Well, yeah, and, you know, I guess we got a little off topic in some ways here, but I want to go with this because
I'm curious.
I'm very. Oh no. I'm curious now. I have to ask then, with the Hillary email situation, your gut as a reporter. Do you think there's a smoking gun there? Do you think there's a there?
I do not know. And, you know, smoking gun is, you know, very clear evidence of wrongdoing or a crime. And, you know, who knows that?
I don't. Well, you know, getting back to Nixon, and we were just talking about Kissinger and the war here. The book talks about the relationship between Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon. You know, that's often been portrayed as this deep friendship, but that's not really what I got from reading this book. How would you characterize that complicated relationship between the president and his national security advisor, Henry Kissinger?
Well, I have scenes where Nixon is on the helicopter waiting for Kissinger and sends Butterfield to go get him. I mean, he's like a babysitter. He goes, Henry, for Christ's sakes, let's get, you know, the president's waiting.
Right.
And Kissinger runs, oh, yeah, I'm on my way. And then Nixon calls in Butterfield and says, okay, I want you to talk to Kissinger. And his deputy, Al Haig, about all these things, he keeps me waiting. He barges into the Oval Office. And actually, Nixon timed. He said, at one point, he had to get someone to call Kissinger 7 times to get him to come. Another time, 3 times. I mean, the president's putting a stopwatch on his aides. You know, where is the control here? Why can't you just say, Henry, you know, damn it, I need you to be on time every time. But, you know, again, there's this kind of wishy-washy, what are the relationships, what are the purposes, Kissinger telling me, you know, well, Nixon would say things, and sometimes they meant something, and sometimes they didn't. I mean, what was going on?
Yeah, it's interesting.
For what purpose? And so, you know, as I was saying, I didn't expect to do another Nixon book, but here was all of this evidence, and it was a jolt to me, quite frankly.
Yeah, it was strange. That relationship, strange. I got to say, there are a lot of strange things about that come out in this book that are just almost comical in their absurdity. Did Kissinger just think that he was too indispensable, that he couldn't be fired, or that the president was too dependent on him?
I don't know the answer to that. and it's what's the job of the president? To figure out the next stage of good for a majority of people in the country. Not a party, not an interest group, not his own reelection, but really presidents, as they have in the past, have done great things, important things for people, for the country. And to have this kind of floating crap game going on in the White House, where you don't know who's up or what the purposes are, it's a sad story, and it's a sad story about this lonely man, Richard Nixon, who was haunted by slights from the past. I mean, there's a scene where he rants and raves about his law partners when he went to practice law in New York City, and he says, he's president of the United States. He said, you know, those SOBs, did they ever invite me to play golf? Country club. Did they? I mean, it's almost, you know, no one invited me to the prom, and I can't get over it. Now, why?
And I have the quote here. This is now that he's president, and he's reflecting on that period after he was VP. He had been in the U.S. Senate, and he's just so angry about these blue bloods in New York. He doesn't feel accepted, and he says, quote, "Do you think one of those goddamn fat cat New York bastards ever invited me over to his country clubs or to his town clubs or any of that? Not one goddamn time." Was there never a point at which Richard Nixon could say, success is the best revenge? I've made it. I can finally be content.
You would hope so. And part of the problem in all of this, when somebody's elected president, Nixon, Obama, you name them, there's an outpouring of goodwill from people, not just in the new president's political party, but the other party, because if the president does well, people have a better chance of doing well. And goodwill, I mean, he couldn't extend it genuinely, it seems, and he also couldn't receive it genuinely from people. And it's a shame.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And then when we come back, Bob Woodward will talk about the complicated marriage of Richard and Pat Nixon, the private loneliness of Richard Nixon, and the man who will forever be known as Deep Throat. Back in just a minute. If you're enjoying my conversation with Bob Woodward, then check out his new book, The Last of the President's Men. And right now, you can download the audio version of this book for free with a special promotion for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be The Last of the President's Men by my guest today, Bob Woodward, or any of Audible's 180,000 titles for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, iPad, or MP3 player. That's audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics. Or click the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And if you like Kickass Politics and want to help keep us on the air, then please support the show by making a donation to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics, or go to the show website and click on the donate link. Your support will help keep us producing new and interesting programs in the future. That's gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. And now back to more with my guest today, Bob Woodward. We're back, and I'm talking with journalist and author Bob Woodward about his new book, The Last of the President's Men. So, Bob, in the accounts of Butterfield's first days at the White House, as I guess he was basically assigned to be Haldeman's shadow, the shadow Haldeman, it's very revealing how utterly dysfunctional the Nixon administration was. I mean, at times I thought, I literally laughed out loud because it was like watching an episode of Mad Men, just the absurdity of it. And H.R. Haldeman almost seems obsessive compulsive, telling Butterfield that he has to make sure to sit on the same side of Nixon as Haldeman does, and he has to use the same yellow legal pads as Haldeman. And Haldeman doesn't even officially introduce Butterfield to the president until he's been there for about a month, as if anything might spook Richard Nixon.
Butterfield, he can't see you. You have to hide.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't like strange people, and until I introduce you, you just... So here's Butterfield running around hiding behind pillars in the White House. Like, what?
Well, how much of that was Haldeman's neuroses, and how much of it was actually Richard Nixon's neuroses, do you think?
It was Nixon. I mean, Haldeman was a, you know, I'm going to do what the boss says.
Yeah.
For the person, he was, you know, the perfect amplifier and transmission belt of Nixon's wishes, as best I can tell.
There's another awkward moment that you bring up in the book. There's this crazy story in here about how Nixon wanted to handle the social aspect of state dinners, and Butterfield was basically assigned with the task of orchestrating it so that the president wouldn't have to talk to anyone. Can
Except
you talk about how he managed that?
Like Arnold Palmer.
Yeah.
One to talk to Arnold Palmer. So the social aides who are young military officers, male and female, the general, who's the military assistant, and Butterfield kind of run a flanking operation around Nixon to keep the other, as Nixon says, the SOBs who keep putting their faces in his, and just bring in the five that he wanted to talk to. And then Nixon says to Butterfield, you know, ask Pat if she wants to do this at state dinners. And Pat Nixon, the first lady, is just aghast, says, oh, come on, Alex, you can't be serious. Says, yeah, well, the president wants to know if you want to do that. And then she says, I like to meet everyone.
Yeah, it's so strange to imagine. Yeah, the question that came up in my mind over and over again in reading this book is, how does anyone who is so isolated and so incapable of relating to other human beings and so asocial, how does a man like that get to the point of being able to be elected to the highest office in America?
Isn't it? I mean, it's utterly baffling. And clearly what he did is he manufactured a other personality to be out there and be jovial and, you know, do the things that were required, but it wasn't real. He hated it, clearly. And whenever he could opt to, and as Butterfield tells, instead of at the end of the workday, Nixon going up to have dinner with his wife or have people in or something like that, they did some of that, but not. Nixon's favorite course was to walk over alone to the executive office buildings adjacent to the White House. He had an office there, and his manservant, Manola, would give him a drink. Nixon would put his feet up on the stool, keep his jacket on, have his yellow legal pad. Manola would cook dinner for him alone, and he would eat alone and have some wine or a scotch or something like that, and then come back, walk back to the residence at about 10:30. Well, you know, you're president. You know, you can get anyone to come to dinner, and the only person you invite is yourself.
Yeah, it's sad. And you talk about how every day, he also for lunch, he would sit in basically a closet adjacent to the Oval Office and eat his cottage cheese by himself at a little desk.
Right. Had to be a certain kind of large curd cottage cheese or small, I forget what, but there are a dozen memos on the kind. And so you know, what emerges is a story of a man who was crippled.
Yeah.
He just was not functioning. He was not relaxing. And to his credit, he did some positive things, and he should, you know, receive acclaim for doing that. But you see the jittery, haunted, inarticulate, lonely guy who was our leader, and then to, you know, to screw people and, you know, just do things who were to people who were close to him, to ignore his wife repeatedly in front of Butterfield asking, you know, Dick, let's take the girls to New York over Christmas. Or Arthur Burns, Nixon's good friend, economic counselor, didn't like some things Burns was doing and disagreeing with Nixon, so he has Butterfield call him up the day before the church service on Sunday that Burns and his wife love to come. And here Butterfield is, you know, Arthur, you're not invited. Well, Burns knew Butterfield wouldn't do that. And it was straight from Nixon.
As part of Butterfield's duty, he acted kind of as a go-between between President Nixon and the First Lady Pat Nixon. And in doing so, he talks about having quite a bit of sympathy for Pat Nixon and even outrage at how the president treated his own wife. He described her as a borderline abused wife.
Yeah.
It comes off very cold. In fact, you talk about, this was amazing to me, how when they would travel to Key Biscayne, Florida, for their regular vacations, they didn't just sleep in separate bedrooms. They had separate houses.
Yeah.
What was that relationship? Was it a marriage, a partnership, an arrangement of convenience?
Well, you know, it had those elements in it. Just from what Butterfield observed and what's on the record, I mean, he was not loving and attentive to his wife. That's part of his responsibility as a husband, not as president, and it's a shame. And one review of the book said, well, you just have to look at Nixon, at Pat Nixon's funeral, and he's crying. If you look at that, you'll see how genuine it is. And I'm sure it was. But you can cry at your wife's funeral and still be somebody who is dismissive and cruel to your wife. And they're not contradictory, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I mean, there we are. This is Nixon, as Butterfield said, Richard Nixon was the strangest man he ever met.
Yeah, and one of the things that comes out that's the strangest was his relationship with certain girls in the secretarial pool and how he had a preference for certain women in the secretarial pool. And there was
but
a weird relationship
out,
there.
Know, wouldn't say it directly to Butterfield.
Right.
But it was clear. And then he made inappropriate advances on two of them. But, you know, they never led to anything. They were never, I mean, it was sad, and it, again, another sign of his loneliness.
Yeah, because it talks about when he would spend weekends at Camp David, he would bring a secretary along under the auspices of work, and then he would invite her to dinner, and then it would turn into this incredibly awkward failed attempt at seduction. It sounds like, it doesn't sound like anything ever came of it.
Yeah. But the assault on the Constitution, the electoral system through Watergate, the mismanagement of a war that still casts a shadow over our country, and how we got cheated.
Just about 10 years ago, it was finally revealed that the notorious Deep Throat was actually FBI Associate Director Mark Felt. If there's one thing that we know about Washington, it's that no one ever manages to keep a secret for very long. it always leaks out. How in the hell did you and Carl Bernstein and Mark Felt manage to keep that secret for 31 years in Washington?
Because we agreed. You want to keep your word. And he was frightened at the time, and he eventually revealed himself in 2005, when there was no possibility of some reverberations on him.
He was that afraid for all those, even after Nixon was gone.
Yeah, and I think, quite honestly, and I wrote about this, I think he was angry at me for, I didn't do it. It was a managing editor at the Post. We called him Deep Throat, and that's, the pornographic movie.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that didn't add to the joy of having been a source.
I'm sure. Well, do you miss the attention in the cocktail party game of people constantly probing you for hints and running their own guesses by you?
No, I do not.
No.
I think it's actually a good thing that we know.
Yeah. You talk about the small group of Nixon loyalists who still stand by him even to this day. I suspect that they would probably defend him even if he had run over their own grandmothers. What was at the core of this blind allegiance to a disgraced president?
Well, just because somebody's disgraced, as Nixon was, and resigns, he still needs friends, and he had some positive things that he did. I don't think anyone, and certainly I would not suggest he should be denied his followers and true believers. I think one of the facts that is overlooked in all of this is it's the Republicans who turned on Nixon. As Barry Goldwater told us, Nixon, too many lies, too many crimes. And it was when Goldwater and the congressional leaders met with Nixon in early August 1974 and told him essentially that it's over. Goldwater said, you're going to be impeached in the House. There'll be a Senate trial. And Nixon said, well, what, Barry, do I have about 20 votes, which wouldn't be enough. You need 34. And Goldwater said, Mike, by my most recent count, you have 4 votes. That's it. And one of them is not mine. Huh. And the next day, Nixon announced his resignation.
Yeah, pretty sad. Well, before we go, I'm just going to throw out some adjectives. You tell me yes, no, or I don't know if you think that they describe Richard Nixon. Intelligent.
Oh, yes. But an intelligence directed at his own political advancement, and I think intelligence broadly should include a definition of what he as president could do for others, and I think there was not enough focus on that.
Yeah. Narcissistic.
Sure.
Paranoid?
Mm-hmm.
Hateful.
At times, yes.
Sad.
I think a lot of this was sad, yes.
Bob Woodward, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. The book is The Last of the President's Men by Bob Woodward, and it's a terrific, terrific book. I wish you the very best of luck with this.
Thanks so much. Good talking to you.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Great. Thanks again.
Well, that's the show, folks. Thanks again to Bob Woodward. It was a real honor to have him on the show, and if our discussion piqued your interest, then you definitely should read his new book, The Last of the President's Men. I'll tell you, I enjoyed it a lot because it really gives a glimpse into the tortured soul that was Richard Nixon and the paranoia and dysfunction and outright malevolence that existed within his administration. It is a remarkably interesting book, and I highly recommend it. So I'm going to include an Amazon link where you can order the book in the show notes and on our website at kickasspolitics.com. And if you prefer to listen to the audio version of Bob Woodward's book, you can download the audiobook for free thanks to that special offer for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics. and you can get a free 30-day trial and a free download of The Last of the President's Men or any of 180,000 titles. Be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes and leave us a review. And don't forget to go on our website or click on the survey link in the show notes to take that listener questionnaire for me. I really want to get a feel for who our audience is, and if you just take a minute to fill that out, that'll be a huge help to me. The other thing you can do to help the show is to go on your Facebook page or Twitter to recommend Kick-Ass Politics to your friends and suggest that they subscribe. And if you do that, each week you'll be entered to win a signed copy of a book by one of my guests on the show. To be entered to win, just go on your Facebook page or Twitter and tell your friends about Kick-Ass Politics. Now be sure to include an iTunes link where they can go to the show. And as I said before, if you promote the show on both Facebook and Twitter, you'll double your chances of winning an autographed copy of my Book of the Week. In fact, you'll be entered to win every time that you recommend us to your friends on social media. So be sure to tag us when you do so. You can tag us on Twitter at KAPolitics, or our Facebook page is just Kick-Ass Politics. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, gripes, and suggestions at comments@kickasspolitics.com. In the next episode, I'll talk with New York Times reporter Stephen Lee Myers about his new book, The New Tsar: The Rise and Reign of Vladimir Putin. We'll talk about Putin's humble beginnings, his ascension through the ranks of the KGB, and his eventual consolidation of power as president of Russia. We'll also discuss Russia's aggressive behavior in Ukraine and Syria, and try to get to the heart of just what motivates Vladimir Putin and his vision of Russia's place in the world, all coming up in the next episode. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass Politics. This podcast may not be reproduced without express written permission. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.